Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Can I ask you some? How come I'm not up there?
Your show closed.
Yeah, but yeah, my pa and brother, they're always up.
They are legends.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I'm David Chen, and I'm the rock that ties the whole garden together. Joining me today, you have seen her work as Jesse Gender on YouTube, Jesse Earl.
Hello, David. I think I wore it more courtesy than you holding that bow right next to my face as we're doing this podcast.
Indeed. Well, those are references to the fact that today on the podcast, we are going to be covering Shogun Episode 5. You'll hear our recap and review of that episode at the end of the show. Of course, our opening clip was from Manhunt, the new Apple TV Plus show about the hunt for John Wilkes Booth in the wake of the Lincoln assassination. So we'll be covering that as well. We also got some TV news for you as well. Before any of that, you can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com or wherever you download your podcasts. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Find us on YouTube and TikTok and Instagram at decodingtv. We're posting new videos every single week. We're really grateful to Jesse Earl for stepping in this week for Patrick Klepek. Jesse, appreciate you stepping in. And you know, Patrick is on vacation, but he's also got some kids with him. So I'm sure he's having a really busy, intense week, not thinking about Shogun for a very small period of time. Thanks for being here, Jesse. It means a lot.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. I'm always happy to step in and chat with you. It's a fun time.
All right, let's get into the television news this week. IndieWire published a study this week. Two-thirds of U.S. adults would rather wait to watch movies on streaming. I'm going to read from this IndieWire poll by Harris X. Quote, a new poll by Harris X, exclusive to IndieWire, found that 34% of U.S. adults prefer to watch movies in theaters, which means a solid two-thirds would rather wait for them to be released on streaming, according to Ali Brady, VP at Harris X. The competition continues between streaming services and the Hollywood engine. While we still see evidence of loyal moviegoers in recent box office numbers, our study shows that 2 in 3 movie watchers prefer to stream movies at home. Despite this causing some upheaval for the industry, it also means that the demand for content is only increasing. Nearly half of consumers say they stream movies weekly, more than 7 times as frequently as those who do so in theaters, end quote. So, Jesse Earl, this seems to be kind of confirmation of what many of us have suspected, which is that the streaming era has altered a lot of how people view movies, their preferences around movies. I am curious, what is your movie watching like these days, Jesse Earl? Obviously, I watch 1 or 2 movies a week in theaters for the film cast, but I'm curious, as a civilian, you know, how do you handle your movie watching these days?
I mean, up until very recently, I tried to go to the movie theater at least basically twice a month, if not more so, but more often I would watch a lot of my movies on streaming. It's gotten more towards watching a lot more streaming movies lately just because I've been super busy, so I haven't had time to go out and see anything other than like the bigger movies that I wanted to go watch. But for the most part, I generally, as a big film fan, as you know, as you are, I try to at least go at least twice a month, if not much more, depending on what movies are out at the time.
Well, according to this Harris X poll, that is not representative of a lot of the U.S. population.
Yeah,
at home, right? The biggest factors for whether someone will go to a theater to watch a movie, first up is the experience of watching a movie on the big screen. I think that actually is a good one. That's a good reason to go to a movie theater. The next closest factor, the quality of surround sound systems, which was checked off by 47% of the survey's respondents, and 39% said escaping from the distractions of home was important to them. The only other thing I want to mention, the movie is exclusively shown in theaters. 30% of people checked that off, and 30% of people checked off advanced viewing technologies such as 3D or IMAX. So anyway, that it kind of shows you like the things that add value that you would think add value to the theatrical experience. Big screen, good sound, IMAX, 3D. Those are the things that are driving people to theaters instead of watching things at home.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the reasons they don't go to theaters, cost of movie tickets, cost of concessions, and 40% of streaming lovers cited the comfort of viewing at home versus in a theater. That's obviously a big disadvantage of watching a movie in theater is you can't pause the movie when you got to go to the bathroom or when you get bored or sleepy. You know, you just got to you got to press on. And I don't know, Jesse, I find it to be quite focusing to have a movie in front of me at the theater, you know, because then you are forced to pay attention. And that's a feature, not a bug. But how do you feel about that? How do you feel about being trapped in a room with a movie?
I mean, I have definitely done the run to the bathroom during the middle of a movie technique. I even almost ran into somebody when I went and saw Dune the other day. I was like running to the bathroom so I didn't miss a second of it. And then someone else was running back. We almost ran into each other. But yeah, I agree. I really love the experience of going to the theater. It's what made me go to film school in the first place. I just enjoy like being in that space, seeing something on the big screen, enjoying it a much better like surround sound system, as they mentioned there, than I would get at home. And then also my partner, we try and watch like a horror movie every week, once a week, and she will always pause in the middle of the climax, and it frustrates me so much, so that when we actually go to the theater, I'm like, ha, you can't pause now. We have to suffer through. But yeah,
sounds like a real healthy relationship.
Very, we love each other very much. But yeah, no, hearing this, like, it just speaks to, I think, just how people have been more and more trained to expect movies to come out quicker and faster on streaming. I mean, not that it's a fantastic movie by any means, but like Madame Web, which just came out, is already out on streaming. So like these movies just come out really, really quickly, and people just go, well, if it's going to be out then anyways, why waste the time? Why spend the money? Why do the whole rigmarole of getting out of the house? And it speaks to, I think, why we need more movies like Dune, where it's like, oh, this is an experience. Like, I want to see this in the theater. Oppenheimer, Barbie, like those kinds of movies are what I think get people where it feels like an actual event to go, rather than just sort of like, there's another, you know, whatever movie coming out that I can just watch on streaming, because they treat it like it's a whatever movie, even the studios themselves, instead of an event. So
yeah, I'm seeing Dune probably for a fourth time in theaters this week, because and I'm seeing it on a 1.43:1, you know, true IMAX aspect ratio screen. And and it's because it's like, yeah, once that's gone, I'll never be able to have that experience again. Like, or unless like Dune 2 comes back in a limited run. But, you know, once it's out of theaters, it'll be very difficult to view it in that way again. And so I want to try to go as many times as I can. It's like riding a ride at Disneyland. You want to go as many times as you can.
Yeah. And I mean, like Netflix. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, please.
Netflix and a lot of streaming channels have like taught us to view movies as kind of disposable. Like, they'll just throw it up and then it'll be talked about for like a week and then it's gone and no one really remembers it or talks about it anymore, unless it comes back in like an award season push. So it's just kind of, it's sad to see a lot of movies like that, just sort of like great films, just sort of like, it's in the churn. So
yeah. The thing that I'm curious about, right, the headline of the article is 2/3 of U.S. adults would rather wait to watch movies on streaming. I'm curious what the trend line looks like, you know, of that, right? And whether, is it plateauing? Is it going to continue to rise till it's going to be like 80% in, you know, 2 to 3 years? Is it going to be 90%, or are we like near the max? That is what I'm curious. And I'm curious to see where that trend line is going, because I think 2/3 is probably bigger now than it was, let's say, 10 years ago, you know, like,
yeah.
And it's because 10 years ago, you couldn't have Madame Web debut in theaters, and then 2 weeks later, you can watch it on your Apple TV. You know, like,
we had to go and watch Madame Web, like the event it really deserved to be.
In theaters, we had to go drag our asses to the theater to watch Madame Web like we were a society, and not Not like now when you can pay, you know, $10 to rent that movie and watch it in the comfort of your own home. So, yeah, I am curious, like, whether this trend will accelerate or my hope is that, like, hey, if this was the plateau, that'd be great. Then it's like, hey, this is something you can work with. This is something that movie studios can build off of, you know. Mm-hmm. I do also just want to say before we move past the subject that it is notable to me that movie theaters have done very, very little to actually improve the experience over the course of the last decade or so.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond, you know, IMAX and Dolby, like changes to the picture and sound, like the fundamental movie going experience has not really changed and still has all the terrible parts of it that we all know. Like sometimes the technology isn't even that great. Sometimes mm-hmm. the people are annoying. Most of the food is disgusting. Like it's not good yeah. for you most of the time, you know? And so that is a bummer. There's very little innovation in the movie theater space, in my opinion. Do you agree with this, Jesse? What do you think?
Oh, 100%. I mean, there was a theater near where I lived in Seattle when I lived up there that up towards, because I know you're in that area too.
Yeah.
Not the specific
which,
area.
Which theater? Which theater?
It was an AMC theater.
Name names. Yeah.
It's an AMC theater that's just up near the Fremont area. I forget the exact name of it, but it actually had like a nice bar. It used to be like an actual theater.
Yeah. And so they had like the AMC Oak Tree 6 or potentially the Sundance Cinemas, one of those.
I think it was like an AMC 10 up mm-hmm. in Fremont area. Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
It just used to be a theater and they had a super nice bar and like nice food there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was just, I loved that theater because I could get like really nice drinks and food there. And I'm going to just tell you my weird thing. My partner and I sometimes sneak in sushi to movies that we that we want to see.
Wow.
Seriously, I mean, it's like I don't want the like Sour Patch Kids or popcorn necessarily. It's like I want to have like a nice meal. Like make it an experience. I remember when I was living in the UK, there was a theater near us. I forget it was, but it was near Earl's Court there where they actually had like a bar in the actual movie theater, like in the theater itself, not like outside in concessions. So you could just go and sit at the bar and like order drinks while watching the movie, which was a fantastic experience.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously there's theater chains like the Draft House that already do that, like, you know, take the theatrical experience very seriously. And, you know, but that is not the common experience that most people have, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a shame. That's a shame. But anyway, I thought it was an interesting poll. 2/3 of U.S. adults would rather wait to watch movies on streaming, and it is available at IndieWire and points to a troubling trend, but not necessarily one that is fatal for the movie industry, just not a particularly encouraging one.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's talk about this other story about Mr. Beast. Mr. Beast, whose real name is Jimmy Donaldson, announced a deal with Amazon for Beast Games, a reality show competition that promises the winner a $5 million cash prize, which is going to be the single largest payout ever in television history. Apparently, the deal is supposed to be worth, I heard, around $100 million, reading here from the Variety story about this. And the whole Mr. Beast thing is really interesting. For those who don't know, Mr. Beast is one of the most popular YouTubers ever in history. And he has done a ruthlessly efficient job of optimizing his YouTube channel to gain the maximum amount of engagement. If you watch his videos, like not only the video titles, but the video concepts, the video thumbnails, the video editing style, everything is designed to maintain your engagement and interest in every piece of content that he's putting out. And he's been wildly successful at it. He's had some really huge hits that have had tens of millions of views. But what is interesting to me about this deal is that it does seem as though he is in the middle of a pivot to more conventional forms of media. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is a big topic on YouTube right now of what is the career of a YouTuber slash creator look like? There have been a huge spate of YouTube retirements recently, people doing this for like 10 to 12 years. And like people like Tom Scott, for instance, and then just saying at the end of the, hey, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. Like
fly off in a helicopter. Helicopter.
Like literally people who are at the height of their powers, like, you know, driving millions of views per video and probably commanding pretty significant sponsorships. So they're making good money. They're making a decent living off it. They're popular. They're well known. And then they do this for enough long enough time period. And then they just decide, I don't want to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think Mr. Beast has not been going for that long, but I think he sees kind of the end of that career coming. He sees like, oh, like every YouTuber eventually burns out, or they end up stuck doing this forever, which is also not necessarily something he wants to do. So he's trying to like broaden his scope of his professional empire. He's moving into fast food, and he's moving into candy and branding candy, and now he's moving into this game show. We are very fortunate to have a professional video maker in our presence, Jesse Earle, whose work can be found as Jesse Gender on YouTube. She is a very popular, well-known YouTuber. And I am curious, like, when you saw all these YouTube retirements happening, but just to be clear, like, I think it was coincidental that a lot of them all happened at the same time. But many of them, I think similar reasons.
The same time.
Is like, they started around the same time. They're burning out. You know, they basically face one of two options. Keep doing this forever or become a manager. Right. Like, and like hire people and then they do it for you. And then for many of these people, they don't want to do either of those things. They don't want to be a manager. They don't want to keep doing this forever because it's hard grind to keep making videos. Jesse Earle, I guess I am just curious, like, what is your perspective on all this? And maybe let's start with your thoughts on Beast Games. And then like, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on being a creator in general.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, there's so many different avenues to go in with this because looking at Mr. Beast's deal here, what interests me too from the other side of this is sort of Hollywood and conventional media's interest in the YouTube space. You know, one sort of speculation that I saw happening around the time of the writer's strikes was people being like, oh, well, a lot of Hollywood will turn to successful YouTubers to try and find more content now that, like, you know, they can't use AI or like they have to deal with stuff with like the writers not being on strike and everything like that, which I thought was, I don't necessarily think is necessarily true. I think it was a little bit short-sighted, but it is interesting to me that like, oh, they're Hollywood is looking for new places to mine content. And Mr. Beast is probably the most, as you were talking about, like he's the most algorithm-friendly, engagement-friendly sort of guy to pull from. No disparagement against his content, but like the idea, a lot of Hollywood has been moving into that sort of tech bro tech mindset that we're sort of seeing, instead of like, we're not here for like facilitating art. We're here towards just like, what's the way we can garner engagement, get more subscribers. And that sort of marries very well with YouTube and the sort of engagement that Mr. Beast's videos cultivate.
Right. And I think part of that is driven by Wall Street in the sense that entertainment companies have not typically done well at the stock market. And it's because it's not a good business, you know.
Yeah.
It's like very difficult to make movies. There's a ton of unknowns. It's hard to replicate. It's not a good business. But what Hollywood's reaction to that has not been, oh well, let's just accept our limitations. It's, let's become tech companies now.
Yep, right? Like, yep, exactly.
We're gonna launch streaming services. We're gonna be like tech companies, and it's like, no, that's not really.
Let's write off movies for tax benefits.
Yeah, like, these movies are just content. They're just like widgets. They're not really like works of art. And I do think that has not been catastrophic, but it's been very bad for Hollywood in general. Mm. This kind of leaning into trying to be more tech based, because it's not what their core competencies are. So yeah.
Yeah, anyway. I it's one of those, like, I don't think it's catastrophic yet, but we are starting to see the it leaning towards that way.
Yeah,
it's
definitely been near catastrophic.
So it's, hopefully there's a shift, but yeah. So that on that end of things with Mr. Beast, that interests me, because it's like, if that's the direction that Hollywood's moving, that's very fascinating, and it has me concerned as someone who does want to kind of break into doing more, like, is, you know, just to not to necessarily promote it over too much, but I'm working on a film right now that is going to be airing on Nebula, and Nebula's whole pitch as a streaming service, they've been discussing this, is like, they want to create a pipeline for creators to be able to like make more art that gets seen on a bigger stage, and not necessarily view it as content, but try and view it as like, what do the artists want to do? So they've been facilitating a bunch of different things like podcasts and stuff like that are led by the creators initiative, which I think is a much better mindset of like, what is the creator, what does the artist want to do? And I think a lot of the problem that you were talking about earlier with the YouTubers who are retiring is, I think a lot of it does come down to that idea of they had to become managers. And they when you run a channel, and it's something that I felt too, is it's a channel. It's a brand that you sort of start to become in charge of. And if you want to grow at a certain pace and continue to grow, you have to treat it like a brand rather than like, here are my artistic pieces of work that I'm releasing all the time. And some people can get away with it. It's like, you know, there's the H-bomber guys of the world who can like be like, oh, I'm going to make a video and that's sort of just my artistic piece that I'll put out into the world. But for channels that start to grow more regularly, like you had MatPat's Game Theory channel, where MatPat just recently retired as well, that became like a content and mill. Again, no disparagement against the like quality of the content, but it's like they release videos every single week on the same sort of topics. And so I think the reason that a lot of them retired is because like, oh, this became a brand, not this thing that I set out as an artist to do. Whereas if you look at it, film with directors, they can become managers, they can become like start their own companies, but generally their intention is to like, I make another project and go to another project and go to another project, which I don't think YouTube marries super well with. So it's an interesting sort of thing to see, where I see Hollywood becoming more interested in the way YouTube works. And I see a lot of the things that made YouTube thrive in the first place, which is like enabling people to make content that could just get out there and have a platform.
Really easy, becoming more low production value stuff.
Exactly.
Right?
That like, it's like, yeah, I'm going to make it from my heart and this is what I want to do and learn how to do these things, becoming wanting to get into Hollywood, but starting to have Hollywood adopt more of the sort of tech mindset that YouTube created. And it's sort of this interesting place, as like myself, who's a YouTube creator, and I see a lot of others who are like, we want to be artists, we want to create work.
Right.
Where does that leave us and where does our content go? Because I'm making my movie and it's like, if I want to get into Hollywood, they're starting to become more content mills as opposed to what's the like next big Christopher Nolan that we want to make.
Yeah, I think you're kind of making this distinction that some YouTubers have between, you know, there's the stuff that you make to keep your channel going, mm-hmm. and then there's the stuff that you really want to make. Now, mm-hmm. for some people, as you said, like the H-bomber guys or the Patrick H. Willems of the world, like those things can be the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and they have achieved a balance between those things. But for many people, there is a difference. And I would argue perhaps for you, Jesse Earle, like the movie you're making is not necessarily the same type of stuff you put on your YouTube channel every week, right?
Yeah. And like, this movie would probably not do well on my channel. Like, I'm hoping my audience will go and see it, but if I put it out there, I don't think it would do as well as I would want it to. So.
Right. But you kind of keep that hope burning, that like that fire burning of like, oh, you know, the next stage is, hey, stuff that's more classically what we would think of as a movie. Mm-hmm. And you may find yourself slightly dismayed to find that Hollywood is actually trending more towards what YouTube is creating as opposed to what it used to create, right? And
yeah,
it's kind of that all these trends are kind of merging together into one big type of entertainment product.
Yeah,
in a way that might be unappealing for people from the old school. So
and there is some success stories. I mean, look at something like Has Been Hotel, which was a really great Amazon Prime series that came out of like a pilot that they released on YouTube. So like there's exceptions and differences. It's not a ubiquitous thing, but it is just one of those like just an interesting trend that I'm seeing in both places. So
before we move on, can I just say I actually find myself enjoying Mr. Beast's videos on occasion.
Yeah.
I have to say it's a guilty pleasure, you know, to watch his videos because they're often really ridiculous. They're often he often wanders into subjects that he doesn't even seem to understand he is tackling. Like there was that one time where he did like the Olympics or whatever, right? He did like a video like where he had like someone from every country or whatever do like this Olympics thing.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And then by showing a world map, he like wandered into like 50 geopolitical like conflicts.
Yeah,
which
country had which country?
Like, is Taiwan its own country, right?
Yeah,
and, like, you know, is Tibet its own country? And so like, there's it's not what I would describe as thoughtful enlightening content. But it does feel to me kind of like the logical endpoint of YouTube algorithmic optimization. And whether you find that appealing or one of the worst things you've ever heard is going to dictate whether or not you like Mr. B's videos. So I actually am kind of interested to see what changes he's going to make to go from YouTube to like a conventional show. Like, is put a different way, right? And I think you have this question too. Is Mr. Beast going to make TV more like Mr. Beast, or is TV going to make Mr. Beast more like TV, right? Yeah. Like, and that's a big open question, and we will find out with Beast Games whenever it comes out. So,
yeah. And I should say too, as someone like, I do like YouTube, I mean, I do my own YouTube channels. I do like the type of content that YouTube enables you to do, but it is distinctly different generally what does well on YouTube versus like what would do well in like traditional Hollywood media system.
Right.
So it's just, yeah, it's curious to see how those will affect each other.
And that is both a bug and a feature, you know, like it's amazing that you can have a 4-hour long video about plagiarism and it's also you know, prevents it from reaching some kinds of people, right? And so, yeah. Anyway, we will see what happens with Beast Games when it comes out on Prime Video, where it will be streaming exclusively. All right, one last story, Jesse Earl. And that is that we saw a trailer for The Acolyte released. We just talked about this show not too long ago. Let's just play a clip from the trailer real quick.
Close your eyes. Your eyes can deceive you. We must not trust them. Tell me what comes into your mind.
Life. Balance. I see fire.
All right, Jesse Earl, let's talk about the trailer for The Acolyte, which got both a full-length trailer and a release date this last week, releasing on June 4th on Disney Plus is when we will just stream it. This is the new Star Wars series that is being showrun by Leslie Headland. According to an interview in Hollywood Reporter, it's going to be a cross between Frozen... Hold on.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Let me see. She actually had a specific thing. She said, it's going to be a cross between Frozen and Kill Bill is what it's going to be. So
fascinating.
And, you know, Leslie Headland recently did Russian Doll, which was an amazing show. And so I was already interested before this trailer came out. And let me just say, after seeing the trailer, I am now super psyched about this show. Now, I in general, I'm not psyched about Star Wars shows, but for reasons I'm going to get into, Leslie Headland is saying all the right things about why this show might be good, and I'll explain why in this interview that she gave with the Hollywood Reporter. That said, before I get into any of that, Jesse Earl, what was your reaction to the Acolyte trailer?
I am in full agreement with you. I've generally been enjoying the Star Wars stuff that has come up, but I don't necessarily think it's been particularly great, Andor aside. Like, I think Andor is the only one that's like unequivocally fantastic, one of the best TV shows I've seen in the past few years. But that aside, I've just been more and more like, oh, all of these shows seem to just be kind of milking the Star Wars brand. And while there's been elements of them that I've liked, they've just sort of been based off of other Star Wars stuff, just trying to like, let's do an Obi-Wan show, let's do a Boba Fett show, let's play with the action figures. And Acolyte feels like what I've wanted Star Wars to do for a while, with the only exception of it being a prequel, like I said, 100 years before. But beyond that, it is an era we have not seen before. It's characters that we have not seen before. It's trying to tell a story that's not associated with the Skywalkers or any of the characters that came from the movies in any specific way. So that all has me super, super excited. I don't expect it to reach the level of quality of Andor, but what does? But I do, I have very high hopes for the series, especially as what I'm sure you'll get into is her interview. So.
Yeah, I mean, let's just say this. First of all, the cast looks freaking amazing. I'm just excited that Carrie Ann Moss is in this, and she looks like she is kicking ass the same way that she was in the Matrix deck from decades ago. Like,
also casting as a Jedi, perfect for her.
Absolutely. It's like she's born to play that role. So that's really exciting. Lee Jung-jae, who is from the main character from Squid Game, obviously also a brilliant and famous actor from South Korea in his own right prior to that. He plays a main character in the show as well, and it looks like he's going to be awesome. Amanda Stenberg, one of the main characters, obviously a big fan of her as well. So anyway, Manny Jacinto in this movie. So anyway, really amazing cast, like a lot of great actors going to be in it. And so that in itself is really exciting. But Leslie Headland gave this interview to the Hollywood Reporter where she said a few things that I think are worth pointing out about this show. First of all, one of the things I thought was kind of interesting was when, you remember when The Mandalorian came out, there was this thing called The Volume, and it was really exciting because basically you could shoot and it would look like you were in the desert, but it was not green screen. It was just a screen that literally looked like what the environment was in the background. And it was like, this is going to change cinema forever. Like, everyone freaking loves this thing. Because like, wow, look how realistic it looks. Fast forward 5 years and people are not as excited about The Volume today. I think it has a very distinct look. I think we've seen The Volume used very poorly. Some people have used it well. Like, example, Matt Reeves, The Batman. Excellent use of The Volume, like beautiful looking movie, really gorgeous backdrops. And sometimes you don't even know that it's The Volume that's being used. Like, it's like, wow, that looks incredible. But I think more often than not, it looks bad. It looks rushed. It doesn't look like it's being used well. The question was asked of Leslie Headland in Hollywood Reporter, what's the Cliff Notes version of your way onto this project? And she said, my elevator pitch was Frozen meets Kill Bill, which I said at Star Wars Celebration. Kathleen Kennedy bought it in the room and said, I love it. I want to start working on it. And we did. We did a lot of development of the scripts. We had a really great writer's room. It took a while to get prep going because these are such huge projects and we did a lot of stuff practically in London. We didn't use The Volume at all. So it was a lot of prepping of the show, end quote. So it's just like, we went from The Volume being like a revolutionary thing to being like, oh, don't worry, we didn't use that. We didn't use The Volume, you know, like, so I thought that was notable. And the show does look like pretty good overall from the trailer. But yeah, Jesse, do you have any thoughts on The Volume these days and any kind of opinion on it?
I particularly hate The Volume. It's not only been used in Star Wars, but I'm a huge Trekkie, and the Star Trek shows that are on right now use it a lot too. And my big problem with it is, like, for a desert, it works great because The Volume works wonders when you have a big, wide open space with nothing around. And so desert's perfect for that. So I thought Tatooine, you're great. But when you go to like other places, it just creates these big, cavernous, empty environments that feel very sterile. Like there's an episode of Star Trek Strange New Worlds where they are on this alien planet and they're sort of like working like cutting wood in some little area with alien people, and it's just like there's just miles of mountains around them. Like, what are they doing in the middle of this empty field just hanging out here? It makes for very sterile environments. So yeah, it's been used very much as like a crutch that I have not particularly enjoyed. And part of the joy of something like Andor was they built those sets. They built those, what was it, Narkina. They built the Fenrix. Where is Fenrix? Ferrix. Built Ferrix. Like, they built all of that that set, and it looked wonderful and felt very real and lived in, as opposed to these big, sterile environments. So, yeah, I'm excited to hear that.
The other thing that Leslie Headland is like literally saying everything that would be necessary to get David Chen into the show, right? She says the shoot went really smoothly. It was long, and there was, as you can see from the trailer, a lot of martial arts. So we had an incredible stunt team that did some incredible wire work, and the talent did a lot of their own action. They said, she also says, quote, we were obviously influenced by samurai films and wuxia films, but also films like Rashomon, where you see one story and then you see it done a different way. So what separates The Acolyte from some of the other Star Wars series is that it's told in that particular way.
And that's playing back from what George Lucas was originally playing from, like old samurai films as well. So
yeah, and I think the closest we ever got to kind of a Rashomon-style thing in Star Wars was The Last Jedi. Remember that? Like, there was a really cool sequence in The Last Jedi where the same events were recounted by different people in different ways, and I thought that was really... really notable because it wasn't really part of the show until then, part of the movies until then, as far as I can tell. I mean, you had the, you know, Darth Vader did kill your father from a certain point of view kind of thing, but like it, you know, it was not shown explicitly on screen. Right.
The other thing too,
I was going to just say one last thing about this interview that really stuck out to me, which is just, this is every Star Wars show creator needs to say this, but I don't think they're going to after this one. Leslie Headland said, the question was asked, I thought you made a wise choice by having a varied writer's room with fans of different eras and then somebody who never flocked to Star Wars at all. And Leslie Headland said, I thought it would be good to have the perspective of a person who had literally never seen Star Wars until she was in the room. And she said to me, why do you want me in the room? I've never seen Star Wars. I have no idea. I think there's a dog in it, but I don't know anything. And I was like, first of all, you're an incredible writer, but that's why I want you here. I want you to be questioning narrative. I don't want myself, who's a lifelong fan, to just be relying on particular references in order to create emotional beats. I want those emotional beats to be earned and checked by someone that isn't super familiar with it, end quote.
Am I
in heaven?
Yeah.
Have I died and gone to heaven in terms of, you know, like that is what we need in the writer's room for series like Star Wars and then to a lesser degree, Marvel probably or DC.
And Star Trek as well.
Is somebody who is not familiar with the show who can tell you whether or not the emotional beats work on their own, because that's how they should work. Jesse Earl, what were your thoughts on any of this or your reaction to this trailer?
I agree completely. Like that quote in particular had me the most excited for the show. I am a huge nerd. Like I love Star Trek, Star Wars, read a bunch of the books, read everything, but I get so tired in a lot of the franchises. And this is saying someone who likes where Star Trek is generally now is it relies often too much on like, hey, look, there's that thing that you like, or building up to that thing of like, here's the character where our arc is going to justify them getting to the place that they were in the movie that you saw. And so it's like, I would rather you tell your own story that fits within this universe and uses the tools of this universe to tell the story that you want to tell, rather than you feel like you have to just adjust yourself to fit this narrative arc of the franchise as a whole. Because I think that just leads to very shallow storytelling. It means that you're not really able to go into any depth. And I think it's a big problem with a lot of the Disney era Star Wars, where it's just going off of these shallow signifiers of Star Wars. Of like, oh, look, there's a thing that looks like the Empire, rather than actually being like, what did we want to tell? And it's why Andor was so powerful. It's like, we want to tell a very anti-fascist story. The story is about fascism, how to fight back against fascism. And hey, isn't it great? There happens to be a fascist empire in Star Wars that we could use to tell that story. And so I think that that's a much better way to go about it. I think we should have more marriage of people who are super big fans and people who are not big fans of the thing that are of franchises to tell stories. So I think that really can lead to some good storytelling. So
absolutely. So I'm really excited about the show. And I'm looking forward to watching it, and we'll be covering it right here on Decoding TV. So anyway, that's a bunch of the TV news that has been happening this week.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's move to the part of the podcast where we recap and review some shows that are on the air right now. I do just want to let people know we're going to be discussing Manhunt episodes 1 and 2 today. We are also going to be discussing Shogun episode 5. And next week, our current plan is to continue covering Shogun. We're going to cover that through the end of the season. So Shogun episode 6 next week. We'll also be planning to cover The Three Body Problem, which is debuting on Netflix. We'll probably cover the first episode or two of that series. All the episodes will be available on Netflix in the next week. So, and probably by the time you're listening to this, it'll be available. So we'll be covering the first couple episodes of that show right here on Decoding TV. Let's get into it. Let's talk about Manhunt.
I was born with a chance to be somebody. I'm gonna be the most famous man in the whole world.
Mr. President, the Confederacy is dead. The Union is saved. The war is over.
Jesse Earl, let's talk about Manhunt on Apple TV Plus. The first couple episodes have debuted. We have only watched the first couple episodes. And this show covers the manhunt for John Wilkes Booth in the wake of Abraham Lincoln's assassination. Jesse Earl, in one sentence or less, do you think people should watch Manhunt?
Yes, but know that you're getting into a very slow burn.
I think I feel the same way. There's some fascinating things about this. It's a really interesting story that, it's an inherently interesting story that's cool to see dramatized. But yeah, it's also has, I would say, very uneven pacing so
yes.
far.
And, yes,
that's kind of the biggest issue. So anyway, those are some overall thoughts. But we are now going to talk about and spoil the first couple episodes of the show. I'm just going to read from the plot summary of the episodes on Apple TV+. President Lincoln is assassinated 5 days after the Civil War ends. Edwin Stanton, his right-hand man, finds himself at the aftermath's forefront. Facing a nation without a president, Stanton grapples with funeral arrangements, suspects, and piecing together a larger conspiracy. End quote. That's probably one of the most interesting things about the show is that, I went to Washington, D.C. when I was in middle school. I went to this theater, the theater that where the assassination took place. And there was like a tour guide who talked through the entire thing in front of me. It was very vivid. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember like how the theater looked and like certain aspects of the assassination, how they went down. But one of the things I didn't fully grasp was the conspiracy behind it, right? And you kind of realize through the show the implications of the idea. It wasn't necessarily just a lone gunman. There was people potentially supporting him, people he was working in concert with. And that's probably the most fascinating, illuminating component of the show is that it kind of pulls back the curtain a little bit on this conspiracy and how confusing and scary it must have been like to be living back at that time, 5 days after the end of the Civil War, when your president is assassinated. But let's talk about some of the creative decisions the show makes. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest decisions that Manhunt makes is telling the story by jumping back and forth in time. On the one hand, this allows certain moments in the main timeline to get some really interesting context. So like you'll see something happen in the main timeline and then it'll flash back and then you'll see, oh, that's why this moment is so poignant. But on the other hand, I found the time jumps to be kind of jarring. Like sometimes we're only in a specific time frame for a couple minutes before we jump again. Sometimes it's not entirely clear when we are in the show. What did you think of how this show decides to tell the story, which is by jumping back and forth in time from the main timeline post-assassination to then having a bunch of flashbacks of what happened before?
I really think it weakens the whole aspect of this show that I found to be the most interesting and illuminating, which is the conspiracy angle of it that you were just talking about. Because part of what's interesting about this show is that, like, look at all these people that were in on this big event. And I feel like the show kind of had this impetus to want to start with the assassination because that's the thing that everyone knows. So put it in the pilot episode. But I think from that decision stemmed this sort of split timeline focus, which then I think just dilutes the ability to really seep into all the players of this conspiracy and really get an understanding of how it all worked together and how it all threads together. So by constantly jumping back and forth in time, like the joy of a good conspiracy thriller is you get to like kind of unravel, either you get to see it all come together.
Right, come together like a heist, right?
Yes.
It's like all these pieces coming, coalescing to have mm-hmm. this big climactic moment.
Or the other way, you have the main character sort of uncovering it as he mm-hmm. goes through and sort of like learns about it. And so by splitting the time frame up like this, you're kind of diluting either version of that. And I think it makes it less powerful. So I really feel like they should have either stuck with like start with the killing and then have the guy uncover the conspiracy as we go, or end with it, or like maybe in the middle of the season have the assassination and then go from there. But I think the split focus, I think just it really dilutes what makes this what the selling point of the show is.
Yeah, I don't love it. I don't love the jumping back and forth. Like, there's the execution of it, which is, mm-hmm. I think, pretty rough. Because sometimes you jump back and forth, you're like 2 minutes, and then you're back already to the main timeline. It's like, okay, well, the question is, why would you do it that way? Like, I'm trying to watch the show and think to myself, why are they doing the jumping back and forth in time? And I think... in my opinion, it feels like a little bit not having faith in the components of the story. Like, because mm-hmm. you can imagine, hey, what if they told the story linearly, right? Like, mm-hmm. what if they just had things happen in linear time frame leading up to the assassination? And I think they didn't do that because they thought it might be too boring. Like, that's my guess, is like you have all this stuff about like, and honestly, by the way, the style of the show is very much like The West Wing. It's very mm-hmm. much like, you know, Lincoln's kind of President Bartlett and Stanton is kind of like the chief of staff. And he's kind of like running around and doing all the, and it's kind of like, hey, we're trying to build a country together. And this is so great. And, but then, oh, now there's people who like, are threatening to destroy all the, and so I think that they want the manhunt itself to be kind of the narrative engine driving the show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they do it this way, is because if they did it the other way, it wouldn't just be about the manhunt. It would be like, there'd be like an entire episode of build up to the manhunt, and they don't want, that's not the story they wanted to tell. But I think the problem with that is that you're still having all those scenes, a bunch of those scenes anyway. Mm-hmm. You're just kind of like putting them in at random, or, you know, somewhat more random feeling points in the storyline. And I do think it makes it feel a little bit like they didn't have the faith of their own convictions that, like, if we just told the story linear, like, it's already a thrilling story to be told mm-hmm. linearly. It's already very thrilling. The idea, the build up to the Lincoln assassination, like, but the thing is, it happens in the first, like, what, 40 minutes of the show. Like,
yeah,
it's like already he's just been assassinated, and it's like, oh wow. Even during that time, I felt like, oh, there was a lot of like exciting buildup to that, and I didn't, even though I know what happened, I didn't know what would happen, you know?
Yeah,
And so I do think that the flashback and flash forward doesn't serve the show very well. I am curious how much more of it we'll see as the rest of the show goes on. Yeah. So
I'm curious also to see, because I think part of it too also comes down to like, oh, keeping Lincoln in the show. If they're going to start with Lincoln's assassination, you flashbacks like, oh, we still get to have our Lincoln, who is like kind of the character that everyone knows. So I think that also might be part of the motivating factor as well.
Right. Played by Hamish Linklater.
Mm-hmm. Who of is, Legion fame.
Yeah. Also very brilliant in Midnight Mass on Netflix. So I am curious what you thought about the casting of the show. Hamish Linklater as Lincoln. Tobias Menzies as Stanton, his right-hand person. Yeah. What did you think of the cast of Manhunt, Jesse Earle?
I actually thought it was really solid. I think everyone's doing really well. I'm also surprised by seeing a bunch of comedic actors in here, too. Patton Oswalt's in there as well. And then Matt Walsh as sort of the doctor on the conspiracy. So there's like a few comedic actors playing very serious roles and I think doing very, very well with it. But yeah, I was just surprised by some of the casting here. But they're all excellent. So
I do think the use of the comedic actors was a little bit distracting for me, I have to say. I'm not opposed to comedic actors trying to do more serious work. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not trying to poo-poo that at all. But, like, just for me, it just was a little bit... Because, like, especially because Matt Walsh has been in a presidential comedy before.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and so I cannot disassociate him from his character in Veep, which he was amazing. He was wonderful
in that
show.
He's fantastic
in
it. Yeah.
And Patton Oswalt has also played a kind of, you know, similar... character in Justified. He played a law enforcement officer in Justified as well, so hard for me to kind of separate them from those roles. I am curious how you felt about the show's style. It did feel to me like there were some anachronisms in the dialogue. Like, you know, what my co-host on the Filmcast pointed out, that people tell John Wilkes Booth, "You look bigger in person," which doesn't really make sense in this context. Like, I don't, I don't know, what did people really say that to stage actors back in the day? Like, that didn't, or you look taller in person, or, you know, also character references, like, you know, you dug yourself a hole or something like that. Like, they kind of use like modern vernacular sayings, you know, or using the phrase guy. I guess maybe that could have been already used back then. But anyway, I'm curious, like, how did you find this dialogue and the style of the dialogue in this show, Jesse?
I don't mind it as much to a degree, mostly because I think a lot of the show is trying to draw some parallels to modern day as well. Like, oh, this sort of post hectic nature of Lincoln being assassinated and in post Civil War. I think there was a couple like references to like, I forget exactly. There was some reference at some point where it made me think of like, oh, January 6th and President Trump and sort of the election coming up that we have, that is very stressful for us here in America for numerous different reasons. So I think the show is trying to direct us towards connecting this series to a more modern context. So I think in that vein, the anachronisms kind of work. Honestly, I just sort of wish that they would lean into it further or go the opposite direction. Because, yeah, you're sort of saying it's just a little phrases here that kind of bump you, despite the fact that they have very meticulously recreated the era in the visuals. So I would have, if we're going to go with some anachronisms, I would have leaned into it a little bit more or pulled back on it instead of the sort of like middle ground.
Yeah. I as you point out, though, the show does look amazing. I think.
Oh, it looks fantastic.
Yeah. You know, we were just talking about sets and how they're really important, but like, yeah, the really intricate sets, like, you know, and there is a lot of CG use as well, but it feels like a really good mix of the two. The costume, the wardrobe, the makeup, the props, right? They all look like kind of period appropriate props. Like, a lot of the show looks like it was lovingly recreated. Let's talk about some of the sequences from the first couple episodes that I thought were kind of notable. I want to say one of the most vivid things I remember from being told the story of John Wilkes Booth is him shooting President Lincoln in the head. He then leaps from the balcony onto the stage and breaks a small bone in his leg. That's kind of what I was told, and then kind of limped off the stage. And I was really curious, like, oh, how are they going to do that in the show? Like, how are they going to like show a guy jumping off the stage and looking like he broke his leg? And it turns out they did a really incredible job of that. Like, just the entire assassination sequence, I thought, was really well done. Him hiding behind, like, waiting for the right applause line and then shooting President Lincoln and so forth. I do have to say, not sure what the point of waiting for an applause line was if you're then going to dive onto stage.
Yeah. It's like, oh, it's just to hide it. But then, oh, look, I'm in the middle of everything.
Right, I'm in the middle of it. It's like, okay, I understand if you're going to like try to do it and then like escape into the shadows, you know? Yeah, he really didn't make it easy on himself by leaping onto the stage, breaking a bone in his leg, and then screaming, you know, freedom for the South, and, you know, running away and trying to get on horseback and flee. But the assassination sequence was, I thought, a tour de force, just really well done. Any sequences from the first couple episodes, Jesse, that you thought were worth highlighting?
That I really, really liked. I also, just to call out in that sequence too, the part that I really enjoyed was the whole setup of the horse, where it's like you have this one guy who's supposed to help John escape, but he's like, you have to watch the horse and also hold the door for me for when people come chasing. And he's like, I can't be in two places at once. And then there's this other guy who's holding it for him, who had no idea what was going on. So I thought that was a nice little piece of tense moment. I'm trying to like think through some of the other sequences. There's nothing like that particularly stands out. There's great moments here and there that I really enjoy. We're going to talk a little bit more about Stanton, but sequences with him sort of dealing with the emotional aftermath of Lincoln dying and sort of watching his dead body. There's also the moments where Booth is escaping into New Jersey and he runs into that the guard there, who's like, oh, you're not getting past, and then recognizes him as an actor. which sort of feeds Booth's ego at the same time that he's like trying to like, I need to get out of here. So right. I do think that that characterization of Booth is kind of fun as well, of him being like, I'm doing this to get famous, like to be known.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Jesse, I think you and I are aware of there is a very healthy and robust failed right wing actor into or failed actor to right wing extremist pipeline. In the world, right, throughout all of history, including present day, it's happened. And John Wilkes Booth, perhaps one of the earliest, you know, failed actor into right wing extremist pipeline, you know, people through that pipeline. That was another scene that really felt like it was pulled from the modern day. I'm like, did that really happen? Where,
yeah, I doubt. Yeah.
Where he's like, oh, my wife loves you from the stage. You know, sure, I'll let you through in dereliction of my duty. You know, like that. Mm-hmm. It felt like a scene from a sitcom, basically, that would happen in modern day. So maybe it did happen in real life, but it felt very weird and very anachronistic. The series focuses on two primary characters, John Wilkes Booth, played by Anthony Boyle, and Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, played by Tobias Menzies. I'm curious, like, which one of these plots are you most interested in? Booth's whole plight or Stanton's desire to try to make things right in the wake of this killing?
I am way more interested in Stanton. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that all of that stuff works really, really well. I love his sort of guilt and kind of bromance with Lincoln. I think he's even called his war wife at one point by
another kind of anachronism. I was like, did they have a concept of war wife or work wife back then? Was that a thing?
Yeah. But I actually think that that's really powerful. I really like just seeing he has this bromance with Lincoln and feels very guilty about Lincoln having been killed on his watch when he knew that people would be out to kill him. And then him trying to earn some form of redemption by capturing John Wilkes Booth. Through this. So I think that that's actually really powerful stuff and gets to the heart of that conspiracy element that we were liking, where he's uncovering how all of this connects. And I think that those are some really fun sequences. Booth's segments, I think Booth himself is an interesting character, that sort of, like you say, failed actor to, you know, right-wing guy characterization of him, I think works really well. But because I don't really understand the apparatus of the conspiracy and all the players that he's involved with, like, I don't really have a good sense of it
and what level he's at of the conspiracy. And
I think, again, it goes to that weakness of like how this story is told, is like, because I don't really understand the context that he's within, it's hard for me to get invested in his sequences as much.
Yeah, I mean, there is something to be said about you're kind of finding out as Stanton's finding out. But I agree. I think Menzies is doing a great job as Stanton and is properly anguished about his role or lack thereof in Lincoln's assassination. By the way, the thing about Parker, the bodyguard, not being there, that's apparently based on the true story. Like, he was excused by Lincoln and then Lincoln was assassinated, and Parker was very torn up about that afterwards, as you might imagine. I think the only thing I didn't like about the Stanton storyline was when he had a dream sequence where he stops John Wilkes Booth from killing. That was like a little bit too on the nose for me. That is making the subtext text, basically, you know. But yeah, I think the Stanton stuff is pretty interesting, and kind of just thinking through all the implications for the country. Like, are we going to go to war again? You know, is this, you know. One last anachronism is there's a thing. This is the second or third time it's happened this year where somebody will drop a line into a movie or TV show that's clearly meant to reference modern day, but it still works for back then as well. Where in this show he says, you know, this is the United States of America. We're not a country that replaces president. We replace people with elections, not via coups.
Yes, that was the line that I was trying to remember earlier. Exactly. Yeah.
And it's okay. We get it. It's still you're still relevant, manhunt. Okay, we get it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I saw a movie at Sundance that was that took place in the 80s, and they were dealing with Nazi skinheads in this movie, and somebody was like, I can't believe it's 1985 and we're still dealing with Nazi. You know, it was like, It was like, okay, yes, I understand. But it's also appreciated because, hey, it is ridiculous that we're still, not only are we still dealing with some of these things, there is debate about the right and wrong of some of these things still.
Mm-hmm.
So, anything else about the first couple episodes you want to highlight, Jesse Earl?
Nothing to highlight. One is just more curiosity. Is I'd be curious to hear some criticism from black folks from the show, because there are some black characters in the series, but they're not as front and center. And I do know that there was many complicated feelings around the time and around Lincoln as a person, because Lincoln as someone who did, you know, do the Emancipation Proclamation, but is much more of a political move rather than, you know, a something like a moral decision. And they played it up more as a political element of his campaign, but the show seems to play it more as like he really believes in it. And I know I saw some criticism of that when it was portrayed that way in the movie Lincoln. From people of color watching that film.
Right.
So
the idea being that the movie, and then I think also the show, I guess, mm-hmm. To some degree, portrays Lincoln as believing in the kind of fundamental human rights concept, you know, behind the Emancipation Proclamation, versus like this is politically a good thing to do.
Exactly.
You're saying in reality, it was. There was a significant political component to it that is not often reflected in these works.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Thank you for kind of drawing that out. Yeah. I agree. And so I'd just be curious to hear like from critics of color to what they think about that film. So, or about that aspect. Sorry, not that aspect of the show, I should
say. Yeah. I do think that one of the things I really appreciate about a show like this existing, other than just its inherent educational value, is that one of the big lies we have been fed in our education, or it's not really a lie, it's more like a false impression we've been given, is that progress is a straight line. Or that progress is inevitable.
The long arc of history.
The long arc of history bends toward justice. And and I wonder which foolish person could have said anything like that on a public stage seen by millions of people. But I think that when you watch a show like Manhunt or anything about kind of these great upheavals in American history, you see that progress is often not a straight line. Sometimes it can be characterized more like a pendulum. Sometimes it can be characterized more like an earthquake. But either way, there are always people that will resist it. There are always people that will violently push back against it. And just because there is violent pushback doesn't mean it's wrong.
Yeah. Right?
And I think that's one of the services that a show like this provides, is like, hey, showing, hey, it was messy. It was terrifying. People didn't know if they were doing the right thing. And ultimately, it wasn't until, you know, a lot later that they were the people in the situation were vindicated.
Yeah.
And maybe they're still in the process of being vindicated to this day.
Yeah.
Unclear.
And yeah, it kind of speaks to just something that I think you sort of alluded to the Martin Luther King quote there. But just something that I see often with works like this is with characters like the our impression of Lincoln throughout history is that he was this moral stand-up guy instead of the politician that he was, who was making political moves. And there is a tendency in American history to sort of smooth out history to make clear good guys and bad guys. Like Lincoln was the good guy, the South was the bad guy.
Right.
When it's like, it's often a much clearer shade of gray. And obviously, like, you know, fighting against slavery was the right thing to do, very clearly, but there it was not so much motivated on the moral aspirations of that as it was like a political calculus. And so I think this sort of tendency to portray Lincoln as like, yeah, I really believe in the full morality of this choice, I think lets us not wrestle with the complexities of people and of our history. And so that's just one thing that always frustrates me. And like the Martin Luther King quote, like he's another person who was towards the end of his life much more radical as a figure that we tend to just say like, yeah, he believed in like working within the system, and we sort of prop him up as this just this guy who's like, oh yes, civil disobedience, when Martin Luther King was a much more radical person than we tend to be thinking about him. And we tend to smooth out those hard edges in our history that I think is somewhat deleterious to us to be able to talk about politics today.
Right. And if there were political calculations to Lincoln's decision making, like what does that mean? You know, does that mean that it was wrong for him to be, you know, like there's all these nuances that kind of get sanded away as a mm-hmm. result of that. So agreed with you there, but I like that history is messy mm-hmm. and also we're living in it, you know, and it's normal that it is as messy as it is. And it wasn't always a straight line, and it wasn't always inevitable. And that's what ultimately, I think that's what Manhunt succeeds in mm-hmm. is showing us that. And that's why ultimately I still come out more in favor of the show than not in favor of it. So.
Yeah, definitely agreed. I'm definitely enjoying it. I'm curious to see where it'll end up, but I will definitely be tuning back in next week for it.
I don't think we'll be covering this further on Decoding TV. Just want to let people know, but it's a show that we recommend. We might continue watching it, and if we do end up getting to the end, we will probably at some point do a bonus episode, but like no immediate plans to cover the show at this point. Just want people to know. All right, Jesse Earl, let's talk about this week's episode of Shogun.
All of this is my doing. We should not be seen together. From this day forward, the only words we share will be from others' lips.
I ask that my ship and my men be returned to me so that I may leave and not return.
Jesse Earl, let's talk about episode 5 of Shogun, which is entitled Broken to the Fist. Let's do quick reactions to the episode. Did you like the episode? Did you not like the episode? And then we will review and recap and spoil the entire episode. What'd you think?
I love this episode and I love the show. I know I came in for the first two episodes, so I was on that podcast and I haven't talked about it since, but I've been adoring this show, and every episode is just a feast of fantastic writing and scenes and character development. Like this episode has, there's like a, I think it's like a 20 minute or something, a very long, like just dinner sequence that's just has so many ups and downs, is incredibly tense, like really surprising. Like I and there's moments that breaks my heart. There's big action beats. And yeah, this show, it just in the course of an hour, I feel like I have just experienced so much. And it is just truly fantastic on every level.
Yeah, I mean, this is an incredible show. It continues to dazzle. It's like pretty much a perfect TV show, I would argue. Mm-hmm. It's everything I am looking for in a TV show. That last episode and this episode have both had the same formula, which is in a 55-minute episode, 50 minutes of just people in rooms talking, and then a shocking act of like violence or action. Right?
Mm-hmm. Like, oh gosh, I gotta come back.
Yeah,
next
something like shocking and large scale happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's basically the whole episode. And that is a perfect formula for stuff that I am into personally. I think mm-hmm. the show is great. It continues to dazzle each week, it continues to impress each week. It's just really well done on every level. And it's a show that really respects its audience and trusts its audience. Mm-hmm. Huge extended dialogue sequences that take place in different languages. And it's just like, hey, you know, audience, we're going to just trust that this is so good and so compelling. You're going to come along for the ride. And at least when it comes to the people on Decoding TV, they are accurate. They are correct in that. So mm-hmm. let's talk about what actually happens in this episode of Shogun. The episode begins with Toranaga returning back to the scene with like 1,000 guys. And then we discover that Buntaro, Mariko's husband, is alive. Were you surprised, Jesse Earl?
Not in the slightest. When I saw him like go off to the side, I think it was like episode 3 or whatever, where he's just like fighting between houses. I'm like, I didn't see him get his head cut off or anything. He's definitely coming back.
So anyway, he's alive, and Toranaga commands Buntaro to move in with Mariko, who is currently living with Blackthorn and Lady Fuji. It's gonna get awkward, but you can't have Mariko just living with Blackthorn and not her husband. That would be scandalous. So
mm-hmm.
this is obviously the best solution for everyone.
It's a great setup for a sitcom.
Yeah. Toranaga also confronts his son, Yoshii Nagakato, about his actions. He's upset that his son allowed himself to get used and gives the analogy of a falcon who could be trained to hunt on another's behalf, which is what gives the episode its title, Broken to the Fist. The idea being that, like, hey, some falcons you can lure with in certain ways, but some falcons you can get to just do all your work for you. And he's mm-hmm. worried that his son is used in that way. He's more offended that his son let himself get used than he was with the actual outcome of what happened, right? That was my perception.
Yeah.
So anyway, At that point, Blackthorn is given the gift of a pheasant from Toranaga, which he interprets as a great honor. Blackthorn then hangs up the pheasant at his house and clumsily says that anyone who touches it in the house should die. Now, Jesse Roll, I was very confused by what all this, like, why would you hang up a pheasant? Clearly it's going to start rotting and stinking.
Yeah, that's what I was curious about as well.
So I'm going to read here from our article from Esquire. According to Field and Stream, it's normal to let pheasants mature untouched for a couple days in conditions of 40 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. The decaying process not only makes it easier to skin and feather the bird, but it also tenderizes the meat. Animals experience rigor mortis in the 24 hours after they die, which causes a tightening of the muscles that can lead to tougher meat. That's no bueno. Since it's winter on Shogun and the bird was hanging for only 2 or 3 days at most, I'd say that Blackthorn knew what he was doing, end quote. So there is an explanation for what the hell Blackthorn was doing. Now, whether he was executing this perfectly is up for debate, but I think the spirit of it is that letting it kind of sit there for a little bit was a way of, was on the path to preparing it for a hearty meal of some kind, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of what the implication is. But it is interesting how the show doesn't explain any of that stuff. Like it just expects you to understand all that. So, which I respect. So anyway, Buntaro, who is also known as Lord Toda, who is also Lady Fuji's uncle, finally comes to visit the house. He's not happy that he has to live with these people. And he and Fuji have a tense conversation about how she hasn't bedded Blackthorn and how, according to Fuji, the Anjin prefers the company of other women, which I thought was like,
ooh, spicy.
Kind of a dig, kind of like, maybe you want to see what your wife's been up to. You know, Jesse, we didn't have you on the podcast last week, but what was your interpretation of whether that was Mariko that slept with Blackthorn last week?
I thought it was, but then I listened to your because I watched the episode and I was like, oh yeah, that's her. And then I listened to your podcast. I'm like, maybe it wasn't. So I had to go back. So now I'm questioning as well. But I believed it was. I thought it was.
I think certainly based on this episode, the heavy implication is that it was, right?
Yes. Yeah.
But I think that they left just enough doubt that you could believe that it wasn't, you know, but I think canonically it was.
But indeed.
Yeah, and so that would make Fuji's comments very pointed in this whole sequence. But then Buntaro, Blackthorn, Fuji, and Mariko meet over dinner. This is the main centerpiece of the episode. It goes on for like about half the episode.
Yeah.
And it's tense. Blackthorn presents rabbit stew and everyone's super grossed up by it. And then they start mocking each other. Buntaro mocks Blackthorn's eating style and Blackthorn mocks their sake cups and they get into a drinking match. Pause here for a moment. I think the food in the show is really interesting and how they depict the food. He presents this rabbit stew, which, by the way, I have to say, it looks kind of good to me.
Yeah, I thought it looked really nice.
Last week, it was either last week or the week before, Blackthorn had natto. Have you ever had natto, the Japanese soybean food?
No, I have not, actually.
I have had it before, and it is not for me, but Blackthorn did a good job of describing it. It's like, it tastes like kind of like very cheesy. It kind of tastes like this cheese. And I appreciated that Blackthorn was trying it. So anyway, go ahead.
Well, I just like that the show uses food quite often. It is like a way to describe culture and showcase people's differing tastes and ability to connect. It's an often underutilized tool to like showcase characterization, but it's really, really used well here.
Indeed. Indeed. So anyway, they get into a drinking match. And at some point, Buntaro gets so revved up, he shoots two arrows into the same fence post right near Mariko's face. And when Blackthorn steps in to defend Mariko, Buntaro asks Mariko to tell Blackthorn her story. Turns out Mariko's father killed Kurudo-sama, who was the corrupt leader before the previous Taiko. As a result, her whole family was hunted down and her father was forced to kill her entire family before committing seppuku himself. Because Mariko was married, she did not have to fight, and Buntaro forces her to live. You can kind of tell, but neither of them are happy with this arrangement. You know, Buntaro feels like her presence is a stain on his honor, and obviously, Mariko is not being treated particularly well in this situation. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, what did you think of this backstory, this entire scene? Any other comments on this whole sequence?
I this whole relationship between Mariko, Blackthorn, and Buntaro is fascinating. I've just the complexities of it and how you see it all play out in this sequence where you see Blackthorn attempting to be like a gracious host, but then having to go through Mariko, who will like soften his words, or like just the translation sequences in general of like how Mariko chooses to interpret Blackthorn's words and other people's words back to Blackthorn is fascinating to me, especially as Mariko it plays a role in this dynamic as well. Like it's just it's so deliciously complicated, and I love how it also plays into like how Blackthorn holds himself, that like there's moments where Blackthorn's trying to be gracious, but Buntaro reads him as just like a savage, but then isn't like kind of gets into that drinking match through like the slurping of his food as well. So it's not just translation. It's a very intricate sort of dance between body language, words, and relationship dynamics that I think this sequence just masterfully plays upon in so many ways.
I agree. I think the translation scenes are so, like, I've never mm-hmm. been so riveted mm-hmm. by watching a translator, right? And mm-hmm. and usually, like, the translator is a thing that the show or the film needs to get past. It's like an obstacle to deal with. Mm-hmm. How do we get the audience engaged? But here, I am just so fascinated by what Mariko is saying, what she's thinking, how she's going to interpret what Blackthorn says to Buntaro and vice versa. It's a great way of taking what has typically been a liability in TV shows and films and kind of turning it into an asset of, wow, these three characters have this interesting interplay with each other, and the translation layer is a really meaningful part of how they are mm-hmm. interacting. I just think it's so compelling and interesting.
Yeah.
I also saw this, do you use Blue Sky, Jesse Earl?
I do, but not super often.
So on Blue Sky, it's kind of a Twitter competitor. They don't call them tweets. They call them skeets on Blue
Sky, which I think is beautiful. I'm here for that.
And I saw the perfect skeet today, which was by somebody named Depeche Joe on Blue Sky. And it was like, you know how some tweets are like a dialogue sequence between two characters? So this is mm-hmm. a dialogue sequence. So, you know, Blackthorn says, "Tell Torunaga Sama that they are beating his ass in the quote tweets." And then Mariko Sama says, "The Anjin wishes to express concern at the reception of your most recent posts." Which I just thought was like, that is an amazing
that is hilarious.
Of that dynamic.
Yeah.
So nicely done, Depeche Joe on Blue Sky. But yeah, that's essentially what it is. It's like both of these men saying horrible things to each other, and then Mariko trying to soften it, right?
Yeah.
With each person. So
there needs to be more movies that are and TV shows that deal with translation. The only other one that I can immediately think of is there's a French film that I really love called The Translators. Mm-hmm. Which is
what's that about, Jesse?
I wonder. Yeah, it's a good thriller movie where like a bunch of it's just a thriller movie where a famous book needs to get translated into a bunch of different languages, so the publishing company, so it doesn't leak, shoves a bunch of different translators into a bunker, but then the book leaks, and so they have to like backtrace how it was translated and figure out like which one of them actually released the book early by figuring out how different things were translated and interpreted through the translating process. So it's an interesting sort of discussion on that. And I think more movies and TV shows should play with that.
I would say other movies that feature translators or translating in interesting ways. John Woo's Wind Talkers, not a very good movie, but like that was kind of a cool, do you know what I'm talking about, Jesse Earl?
I've not seen that one. No.
Are you a John Woo fan though, Jesse?
I've seen a few of his films, but I wouldn't necessarily say I'm a huge fan. But
John Woo is like a god to me. So like anyway, that was one of his not particularly successful American films. But also the Denis Villeneuve movie Arrival.
Had
a big like translation component to it that was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. So anyway, all right, back to this episode of Shogun. So. Mariko, after being forced to explain her backstory, leaves abruptly. And then later, Blackthorn is awakened by the sound of Buntaro beating her. Blackthorn then confronts Buntaro outside, and Buntaro asks for forgiveness for disturbing the harmony of his home.
Mm-hmm.
Later, Mariko and Blackthorn discuss their feelings about the situation. And we kind of, you know, Mariko gets some of the best, most, I guess, poetic elegiac lines of the whole show. You know, we live and we die. We control nothing beyond that. She says that a few times, but she also says this line like, I will give my husband nothing, not even my hatred, because that is what he merits. End quote. Really amazing line, amazing delivery by Anna Sawai. So I think this was basically what we're seeing in this episode is Blackthorne's value system colliding with the value system of Japan, and he mm-hmm. he thought he had like kind of figured it out, but he learns this episode that he really really doesn't have it figured out. He doesn't really understand it on any meaningful level. Mm-hmm. And you know, Mariko says that they'll never basically speak again after this. That she's she thinks that she's decided, I have a job to do, I'm gonna do it, and I'm not gonna let any personal feelings get in the way of it. Any thoughts on the Mariko and Blackthorne conversation or relationship this episode, Jesse?
Well, I think, yeah, it just goes to the heart of the entire themes of the series. I think it's the culture clash and value systems, like this, the difference in their values as Mariko and Blackthorne sort of discuss them here, where Blackthorne sort of values freedom completely, freedom from anything, freedom from any being beholden to any ritual or person or group, versus Mariko, who is very much inundated with ritual and honor and what she like the just the systems that she's within, and how they're both sort of limited by both of those perspectives. Mm-hmm. And I think that mm-hmm. these two characters coming into contact with each other sort of represents the larger themes of the series, of just how people interact with each other, translate each other, how people interpret other people's intentions through their own context rather than on the other person's context. So I think that that is it's just a great dilution of that. And again, this is a really well done romance, I would even say. Romance might be the wrong word. Like there's definitely some feelings between these two characters. And the show never takes a moment to be like, hey, they definitely have feelings for each other. Look at them being together. But you understand the subtext of this whole sequence of like, Blackthorne has feelings for her, she has feelings for him, but it's complicated by all of these situations that they're within.
Yeah, the thing that I thought was most potent about that conversation was the idea that this desire for freedom itself is a trap.
Mm-hmm.
That they're like, that valuing individualism and self-determination above all actually does come with downsides, as mm-hmm. we have seen in the United States, right?
Yeah,
seen that with, I'll just say gun culture as an example, like just, you know, there's a huge cost to that. And we are reaping, we are reaping the cost of that on a daily basis here in America. And so that was just fascinating in a way I'd never even heard it articulated in that way until this show. And I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, it's about the balance between individualism and community, because both going to both extremes mean you lose yourself. And so like, where's the balance of that?
Yes.
Where do we care about others, but also ourselves?
So. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So later, Blackthorne returns home and he learns that the rotting pheasant was creating a problem for the entire town, with some fearing that it was a Tataragami. So I did not know what a Tataragami was. Did you know what a Tataragami was?
No.
So I looked this up, and according to Wattpad, Tataragami are powerful spirits which bring death and destruction, fire and famine, plague, ooh, war, and all forms of calamity. They are some of the most powerful evil spirits that haunt Japan, and have done much to shape the culture and politics over the country's long history, end quote. So people potentially fearing that this rotting creature was bringing bad juju into the town. So anyway, turns out the townspeople decided something needs to be done about this. So his gardener, Uijio, decides to dispose of the pheasant, and as a result is put to death because of the offhanded comment that Blackthorne made. Disgusted by their system of honor, Blackthorne tells all of his servants at home to go away. And I'm just going to go straight into, you know, I want to talk about that scene, but I can just go straight into the next scene, which is very, very kind of related, where at a meeting with Blackthorne, Toranaga, and Mariko, Blackthorne tries to ask Toranaga if he can leave, because he's like, hey, I taught you how to use the cannon. I have fulfilled my end of the bargain. Time to get me and my men back. We're going to get on our way. And at that point, Mariko tries to figure out what's going on with Blackthorne, and Blackthorne's clearly upset because of the death of his gardener, who was, by all accounts, seemed like a pretty cool dude, you know? And then it comes out that it's because of this whole situation with the pheasant that Blackthorne is upset. By the way, I love that Toranaga just gets up and leaves halfway through the meeting.
He's just like, I have other shit
I need to do, like stare at this, like stare at my men over there in the valley. Mm-hmm. All right, Jesse, this is a really interesting situation. I was reading Episodic Medium, a great newsletter with Miles McNutt, about this episode, and one of the dangers that a show like this can fall into is re-perpetuating the white savior narrative, mm-hmm. right? And what that means is, like, white person comes in and masters a culture, and not only does he master the culture, but also he's got a few things of his own to teach him about mm-hmm. how to live life, you know?
Tom Cruise coming in and Last Samurai.
Last Samurai, you know, and, you know, Avatar, all that stuff. Like, there's mm-hmm. there's many movies like that, and so what you don't want to see is a show or movie that kind of adheres to that very warmed over, not interesting, and borderline offensive trope.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, does this episode take steps towards the white savior narrative by showing Blackthorne's disgust at their system of honor? And I was reading Episodic Medium, and they're saying, yeah, it kind of does, like, reinforce the white savior narrative. And honestly, Jesse, I'm just going to say, that was not my reaction to this at all. My reaction was when that conversation that Mariko and Blackthorne have at the end, where she says, you know, the pheasant was meaningless. And she says, your words gave it meaning, basically. Like, mm-hmm. you gave it meaning. And it kind of forces Blackthorne to reconsider. I think Blackthorne is the one learning in that situation. Like, it's not the Japanese people learning. It's Blackthorne is learning, like, oh, I can't just say random shit, like, and expect life to keep going on normally. Like, I need to actually be serious about what I'm saying. I need to expect that people will take me literally and seriously. And so for me, it was like, wow, like, it's the Japanese that are educating Blackthorne, showing him that his words have meaning and he can't go willy-nilly doing stuff. But Jesse, I think there's also the possibility that people might watch this and be disgusted by the Japanese way of life in this situation. Mm-hmm. And how dare you kill that old man for doing basically nothing wrong? So how do you think about all this went down, Jesse?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you completely on that read of it. I mean, you even get that scene earlier where he does learn that the gardener was killed, and I'm blanking on her name, but the Blackthorne's...
consort,
yeah.
Fuji, yeah.
She is so very clearly distraught by the fact that she had to do this because of his words.
Yes.
Like, she plays it so, so well. You just see, like, she didn't want to do it, but because of the situation that Blackthorne created by his poor choice of words due to his lack of understanding and how to translate and just trying to, like, offhandedly say, oh, don't touch this death, just, like, simplifying it for people. I think what it goes to show, again, him understanding that his every action, every piece that he provides in this world is needs to be precise. And he is not a man who is very precise in many, many ways.
Right.
And so I think that, I think that is about him learning again and going back to the theme of language that we see throughout this whole series and translation and understanding. So I do think that it doesn't lean into the white savior narrative, but it kind of goes into the same thing of, you know, I saw a lot of comments about the recent Dune movie as well, where people saying, oh, this is the white savior film. You have Paul in that movie being a white savior, when the whole point of the movie, and I think the movie makes very clear.
Dune 2. So, like,
sorry, no, yeah, no major. Yeah. I'll keep it right. fairly vague here. But, like, the point of that movie is to be a deconstruction of the white savior narrative. And I won't spoil exactly how that works within the movie, but it is meant to be that. But people are saying it was a white savior narrative, and it goes to sometimes this thing of, like, when you're deconstructing something, you're still depicting it. And so depicting it is it's the same thing I often see with, like, I see barrier gaze trope with gay characters, where people are like, oh, we're going to subvert the barrier gaze trope by killing a gay character but bringing them back, or playing, like, or almost killing them and not bringing them back and not leaning into it. But it's like, you're still playing it by those rules to subvert them. And so there is something to be said of by playing into this, a white person judges another culture, you could have people, because the show is clearly made for, a Western audience by nature of the fact that you see, like, you know, them speaking English instead of Portuguese or something, that people will not read into it. And it's one of those, it's the conversation you always have about art. It's like, how much does the creator, the artist, need to hold your hand in helping interpret something between, or do they provide enough context within the show? Sometimes it is more important to bonk people on the head and say, this is what this is about. Sometimes it is more effective to be subtle, but you run the risk of people misunderstanding it. So I think that this episode does a masterful job of telling the story. And I think what will be more telling is how it sits within a larger context of the series. Because if it does end up being like, oh, Blackthorn by the end of the show, like rescues Japanese culture because he's able to understand something that they don't, and he provides something, then I'll come back to this moment later on and be like, oh, that was an inkling towards that read of the show. But I don't really think that that's the direction the show is going, nor the end thesis statement that it's going to end with. So I don't read that the sequence in that way.
I would argue this is not even a depiction of the white savior. Like, mm-hmm. you're saying you need to depict it to deconstruct it. I would say this is not even a depiction of it, because mm-hmm. I think that Blackthorn's perspective is rendered as it is Blackthorn that needs to do the learning in this mm-hmm. situation. From my perspective, it's not shown as though, like, oh wow, he needs to teach these barbaric Japanese people how to live. That's my interpretation of what the show is trying to say. Mm-hmm. Now, you may have a different interpretation. We'd love to hear about it at decodingtv@gmail.com. But anyway, I just want to get your take on who is the one being educated here. Is it the Japanese?
Definitely Blackthorn.
That's my sense too. But you could see, if people thought it was the Japanese people being educated, that they might think this is more of a white savior show, right?
Yeah. Well, that's what I was sort of getting into. Just to clarify my statements too, it's like the beats of this at the top could lead into white savior narrative.
Absolutely.
And so, like, that's what I'm saying is, like, someone who has been inundated in this type of storytelling for a very long time, that, you know, Western culture has done the white savior story a bunch, they may, because we expect those beats, they may end up reading it that way, regardless of what the show actually does do with those beats later on.
Yeah, let's check back in 5 weeks mm-hmm. and see where mm-hmm. we are. All right, a few other things to mention about what happens in this episode. A huge earthquake happens.
Jeez, talk about a cliffhanger.
pretty big, and I have to say, not every shot was amazing, but some of the shots looked pretty spectacular,
mm-hmm.
of these people just getting swallowed up by the ground. That was amazing. Toranaga is saved. Blackthorn gives him Fuji's father's swords to replace his previous ones. I thought that was an interesting step as well, because we learn early in the episode that Fuji's father's swords, she has this whole narrative about how they came to be that way, and the narrative is a lie, and it's a lie to preserve Fuji's dignity. And by kind of offering him her swords, it's kind of him... Again, it's him being like, I accept that, like, these swords have a story around them, and by passing them to Toranaga, I am continuing that story in some way. So, mm-hmm. anyway, go ahead.
It comes right off that lesson of, like, what you do gives things meaning.
Yeah,
so it comes absolutely. Right off of that scene, so yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. All right, there is a subplot this episode with Yabushige and Toranaga. Yabushige, my favorite character in the show.
Agreed.
He is... the comedic relief of the show. He is so out of his depth. We did get an email at decodingtv@gmail.com. Somebody wrote, do you watch Succession, Jesse Earl?
Yeah.
Somebody named Dawn wrote into decodingtv@gmail.com with subject line, Yabushige is Tom Wamsgams.
Oh my gosh.
And then Dawn wrote,
oh wow.
That's it. That's the email. And now I can't stop thinking about that. That's very apt. Yeah. He is the Tom Wamsgams of the show. If you've seen Succession, he's basically like this guy who is completely out of his depth, trying to play all sides and failing horribly doing so. But anyway, Toranaga accuses Yabushige of manipulating his son into attacking Jozen from last week because Toranaga knows his son ain't that smart. But Yabushige reveals it was his nephew that did it. And turns out Toranaga is actually happy about the result. As a result, Yabushige's nephew Omi gets control of the artillery, but he also needs to find Toranaga's spy. In one of the final scenes of the episode, Toranaga's actual spy, Tonomoto Akinao, manages to frame the dead gardener Uijio of being the spy, So that's the end of that chapter. I'm sure we're not going to hear any more about that subplot ever again. But anyway, yeah, I you know, my one complaint about this episode, not enough Yabushige.
Yeah.
He is my favorite character, and he's always trying to say the right thing. Like, that's the thing you get is from the show, is characters are always trying to say the right thing and failing. Like Yabushige with Toranaga, and then later on, Omi offers Yabushige, he's like, hey, if you want control of the artillery, uncle, you can have it. And he's like, how dare you imply I didn't already have control? You know, like, that is kind of a thing in this world where people are always fearful of making the wrong move. Mm-hmm. And that's often why it's better to just shut the fuck up, you know, in this situation. So
scene where Yabushige just has to be like, oh yeah, well, I'll discipline my nephew. And then Toranaga's like, oh no, he did great. It was really helpful. Like, and then he'd be like, yeah, that was definitely what I was thinking. And the way Yabushige plays that moment, he's just like, I hate, you just see it on his face of like, I know I was just caught in some BS and I just have to go along with it and I hate everything.
Yeah.
It's just wonderful.
Yeah, it's amazing to see. All right. We also get a few scenes with the Regents this episode. They have a difficult time figuring out who to replace Toranaga with. They start descending into infighting. Ishido receives Jozen's head in the mail, so that's a thing that happens. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the episode, Lady Ochiba, who is the mother of the heir to the kingdom, she returns to Osaka. She's impatient for the council to be restored and decides she's going to seize control herself, ending the episode by saying, the council will answer to me, end quote. Yeah. You know, we don't really know that much about that character at this point. So, like, I don't know how that's all going to play out, but it definitely is going to be a complicating factor. Jesse, Earl, any thoughts on how this episode ends and what's going on with the Regents?
Same with you. I'm curious to see how she's going to play out. We don't know enough about her. What I will say is that scene was creepy. Like, that whole sequence was filmed. Yeah. Like, I was like, dang, this suddenly became a kind of a horror movie vibe with her character. So I think that was a very powerful. I know. I think we've seen her before in maybe a flashback or something like that. But regardless, it's a really strong introduction to her character. I was like, oof, dang, this is just terrifying.
Yeah. Before we get to any closing thoughts, Jesse Earl, you want to let people know where they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
Yeah, you can find me at Jesse Gender on YouTube. If you just type in Jesse Gender, you'll find my channel. I had a recent video go out about, if we were speaking about right-wing stuff earlier, there was an anti-trans propaganda film made by a right-wing cult. It was a really terrible movie with some terrible acting, but I go through and use it as a way to, like, not only just make fun of the movie, but to educate about trans issues. So check out that video if you're interested in that. I'm on all the social medias, Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram are the main ones. And then you can also follow me at Nebula, which is the streaming service made for a bunch of YouTubers that I mentioned before, that will be releasing my movie Identities, which is a sci-fi cyberpunk film that'll be releasing later this year that I'm super excited about. So I'll talk more about that when it gets closer.
Big fan of all the stuff Jesse puts out, and super grateful that she stepped in for Patrick Klepek this week. Yeah. It's greatly appreciated. And of course, I do want to mention, if you enjoy this podcast, you can become a paid member at decodingtv.com, get early access to episodes, ad-free episodes, and bonus episodes. And everyone I work with at Decoding TV, Patrick Klepek, Jesse Earl, gets paid. It is because of the paid subscribers that we're able to do that. So become a paid member at decodingtv.com, help support the podcast, and help to keep it going long into the future. All right, Jesse Earl, any closing thoughts on this episode? I think, or anything that I didn't mention or pick up on. I agree with you that the final sequence was really creepy. I am curious how Lady Ochiba, another player entering the game, is going to confuse things. But I do just want to give a shout out to Toranaga again for resigning from the Council of Regents, because he just knew that the reason they wouldn't be able to execute him is because they are sticklers for the bylaws of the council. Mm-hmm. You know, like, they're like, man, we really want to kill Toranaga, but got to follow these bylaws that we got to have five people to vote on this thing, you know? So I appreciate that he was using the bureaucratic system against them.
Yeah.
But yeah, anything else to mention about this episode or any other closing thoughts?
No, I think we hit all the major things. I'm so excited for this show. Like, this is just a meaty, meaty show where I could talk for so long about every single episode. So, yeah, fantastic show. Excited for next week and excited to hear you and Patrick talk about it next week.
I think they have said that the show ends where the book ends. The season ends where the book ends.
And oh, so interesting.
They have no plans for another season, which I just like.
Really?
Is really sad. That was.
Oh, man, that saddens me.
Yeah, that's sad. I mean, it's good to go out on top, but it's just so much work goes into creating a show like this, like having creating the look of it, casting it. I'm a little bit surprised that there's no kind of immediate plans to continue it, but also we've seen many shows continue past when they should have. And like a show is based off, you know, the one that comes to mind is Big Little Lies, the HBO series.
The one I was thinking was Supernatural, which went 10 seasons too long.
But that was based off the 2014 novel of the same name, Big Little Lies, and they were like, hey, we're gonna end it right in it, like it's meant to be a limited series and that's it, and it ended, and I was like, oh, that was a pretty good show. And then they did a second season, which despite having Meryl Streep was kind of a disaster in my opinion. And so I really hope that they don't extend it past the shelf life. At the same time, yeah, I mean, one of my favorite shows that has aired in the course of the last few years, and so I would love for it to continue somehow. So we'll see how things evolve. All right, I think that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of Decoding TV. Huge thanks to Jesse Earle for joining us. We'll be back next week with another conversation about Shogun, as well as The Three-Body Problem on Netflix. Until then, thanks for listening, and see you later.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.